Assalamu alaikum, hello and welcome to a brand new episode of Retail Remix Stories powered by Find. This is your place to get up close and personal with inspiring business leaders who are not just building great businesses, but through their massively transformative purpose, are also shaping the future of commerce in the region. Our guest today is a perfect combination of India's speed, Europe's precision, and Dubai's ambition. Having worked in multiple geographies, he's now the CEO of SixthStreet.com. It's a pleasure to introduce and welcome Vivek Rajakumar. Welcome to the show, Vivek.
Thank you, Dharmendra. And it's a pleasure and privilege to be here and good to meet everyone. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Vivek. I think we've been talking about this for a while. And one of the things that I most admire about you is the amount of data that you carry yourself, right? Every conversation we have, you're able to give percentages and say, you know, Amazon, 70% this happens, right? And I'm sure that's an Amazonian, you know, trait that you've picked up. But how does this tie back to Vivek the person? So keen to know what your growing up was like.
Sure.
And you know, where were you born? How were you raised? Any key influences in your early childhood that has made you the professional that you are today?
Sure. So I'll start by saying that the thing you just mentioned is something I hear a lot. I get a lot. And I have to say, I can't help it. I think numbers just come naturally to me. And then that's how that's who I am. So going back to my childhood, I think I was, I always say that the biggest lottery you can get in life is the parents you're born to. And I was born to two doctors. My dad and mom were both doctors and very hardworking, instilled a very, very strong work ethic in me. But at the same time, they were very different. And I think of them as fire and ice. My dad is very ambitious, very strong fire in the belly, always thinking about what next, and also a great storyteller. So a lot of things that, you know, brought a combination of high performing, high ambition in one person. My mom, on the other hand, is extremely down to earth, the most humble person I've seen in the world, who is highly principled and value driven. Also very spiritual, and I've always tried to imbibe the best of the both the worlds, and help stay composed and calm while still retaining that ambition. So to me, their combination has shaped a large part of who I am today. And on the numbers side, I think one of the my first love in life was maths. So I was always a numbers person. It was something that was very close to my heart. And that's why I broke the pattern in my family and did not become a doctor.
Right.
Because, you know, math was something which I was naturally good at. And I wanted to pursue a field which would allow me to use that talent. Which is why I went the more boring route of engineering MBA. In fact, I also say this, that I'm the only person in my family who cannot save a life. Because my my wife...
Living humble.
My wife and my you know, brother-in-law, they're also doctors. So I come from a family of doctors and the only outcast who's not a doctor.
Right. But I think on a lighter note, you can't save a life, but have you ever felt like taking a life because of the pressure situation that you've been through in boardrooms?
So I think that's one of the key things I've learned over time, that to stay calm, composed, no matter what the situation is. Because this is one of the traits I've admired in the best leaders I've worked with. They have been people who can absorb a lot and yet not transmit that back to the teams. And therefore, the teams appreciate them for being that shock absorber.
Right.
I've also tried to role model that to the extent possible.
Amazing, amazing. No, I think that's great. We'll probably talk more about the leadership nuggets. But slightly going back to, again, growing up days, right? Great example of parents. And I also resonate with that. It's very similar. My father was an army officer. My mom was a homemaker. Very similar. Very aggressive father. Very docile mom. And I think I've taken the wrong traits from both. But I think... other than parents, was there any other, you know, teacher, friends, elders who kind of influenced you to be, you know, take the route that you did? So,
I think there was my grandfather was again a very very important influence in my life. He was very spiritual, but he was also someone who had. Read all the Vedas, he had read the all the scriptures, and he used to love narrating those stories to me. And I grew up listening to those stories, and I also knew, I also learned or picked up my love for reading from him. Even though I didn't go down the scriptures route, I still picked up the reading habit, which I think has been a very, very important enabler for me as well in my life. I read a lot, both fiction and nonfiction. In while I was young, it was all fiction. Over time, it became completely nonfiction. And after my children were born, I shifted back to 50-50 between fiction and nonfiction, which I think is the right balance to have. Wow. But reading has shaped a lot of who I am today, because my grandfather used to say this, that books allow you to travel the world without moving an inch.
Right.
And I truly believe that, because I felt like, I feel like I live different people's lives through books.
Right.
And the kind of experiences I'm able to imbibe through books is completely different. And one of the reasons, a lot of people question me, why do you even read fiction? Non-fiction, they can understand, okay, you get facts, you get knowledge.
Right.
But to me, non-fiction, reading fiction develops an important facet of your personality, because it allows you to create that imagination and the world within your mind, which otherwise, if you're watching something, you are just looking at somebody else's imagination.
Right.
So if you have to really develop your imagination, it plays a big role. So so a large part of who I am today is also thanks to the reading that I've done, thanks to the influence of my grandfather.
Amazing, amazing. And is there a favorite book? I'm sure the favorite books keep changing, but is there a current favorite book?
So as you rightly said, I think the favorite books keep changing, and my favorite book is always the next one I'm about to pick up. but right now I can talk about the books I'm reading. So there is one book called Reshuffled,
right,
which is written by Sangeet Paul Chaudhary.
Okay.
He is incidentally my senior from IIM Bangalore.
Okay.
It's a book on AI, which argues that while everyone is trying to have an AI strategy, what you should really be doing is build a strategy for a world that is shaped by AI.
Right.
It's a nuance, but it's a very, very important nuance.
Right. Yeah. Talk to AI as if you are AI yourself, right? So.
Yeah. So I think we often think that the impact of AI is going to be on automating, on speeding up things. All of that is true, but the much larger impact of AI is going to be in the way it shifts the fundamentals of business. A lot of assumptions or constraints that you think are true today will no longer be true tomorrow, and the principles of the world you live in tomorrow will be very different from what it is today. So to be able to imagine that and then build for that new world is a whole different lens to look at it.
Right. Our founder Farooq is going to be very happy to listen to this, because that's the ambition that we are building Find with as well. So I think off topic, but we also are kind of trying to use AI to shift paradigms of the business, right? Like for fashion, AI garment design to manufacturing, we're kind of trying to shrink the entire 9 to 12 month life cycle into, 3 months. So make the entire business very different from what it was for the last 100 years, right?
Sure.
But I think, sorry, that was off topic, but
I think I have a couple of thoughts on that topic, right? So on the one hand, I think there's a lot of innovation that has gone into how we shrink the value chains for fashion from 9 months to 3 weeks or to 7 days, which is a good, important innovation. But that still predicates an assumption that customers need a lot of selection and you need thousands of options. I would also rethink that assumption in the age of AI to say, do we really need millions of options, or can we actually have lesser options now in a world where AI can allow you to personalize and customize what each customers need, right? And therefore, a lot of the wastage that happens today in the fashion industry, can we actually avoid that? And can we actually create something which is actually required for customers?
Absolutely. Bang on. And I think the first step to that is that you use it to test and scale. So most of the brands we work with take a small capsule that comes at the beginning of the season. So say if there's a summer selection, small selection that hits stores, only in test stores in February. And then based on the entire efficiency that you've built in the system, then you get the larger order back in. So then you're predicting demand much better. Because there's also the problem of, loss of opportunity. And how do you balance between loss of opportunity versus making the right number of SKUs, make them efficient?
Sure.
And then when you're tied up with a smart, reassignment of products from selling stores to non-selling stores, et cetera, then the whole thing becomes sure. far more efficient. So
sure. So I think that's the whole product lifecycle management.
Right.
You started by saying we can have small quantity in stores and test. Yeah. I would go one step even further and say, why in stores? I mean, given the omnichannel platforms and the commerce platforms that you have, why do we even need the physical product before testing, right? Can testing happen in an environment where you haven't even created the product so that you further reduce the wastage there?
Great point. Otherwise. And I think there is some bit of physical attribution there, which is factories, product moving, et cetera, which is still not making it as easy. But I think the vision is what you said, right? Ultimately, it's going to be what, say, Shein does, right? You have garments going on, designs going live, and then you produce only basically the orders that you have.
Sure.
So, yeah, I think aligned. I think great conversation to get started with. Going back to your growing up days, right? You studied engineering and then you went to IIM Bangalore. Was there like a gap in between or did you like pursue? I'm asking this question because a lot of our young listeners want to know, you know, I've just completed my graduation. Should I now go to management or should I get experience and then go to do IIM?
Sure. So I did my engineering right after schooling, and engineering was a default choice because I didn't really know what I wanted. All I knew was I was good at math. And at that point, I think in Kerala, where I grew up, there were only two respectable professions out there, which was engineering and medicine. And between the two, engineering made a logical sense. So I went for engineering. But while doing engineering, there was a pivotal moment where there was one senior of mine who had been to IIM Calcutta, who came to the campus and who gave us a speech about his life in IIM Calcutta. I don't remember any word of what he spoke. All I remember was what he made me feel. He spoke so eloquently that I was wowed. And I just wished that what if I could speak like him one day?
Wow.
And that was so that was such a transformative feeling that I felt that day, that I got so inspired and I decided, okay, I'm going to attempt CAT and see what this IIM thing is. And unfortunately, I was able to make it. I landed in IIM Bangalore. So yes, I didn't work at all. So right. this one gentleman made me so convinced that, you know, I should go for CAT that I just directly went there and I landed in IIM Bangalore. So only after I landed there, I realized that 90% of my peers all had work experience. So I fell into a very, very awkward place where I was a general engineer male without work experience. The combo which landed me in a place where, you know, I was the least valuable member to be part of any group, and justifiably so, because others came with their unique experiences from different industries. But interestingly, eventually, you know, there were four of us who were left out, who couldn't find any groups, and then we became very good friends as a result of this, right? The outcasts became the underdogs became very good friends, and it happened to be a good thing eventually.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you were to ask me today, for anyone who's thinking about MBA, I would strongly recommend working for a few years before doing the MBA, because I felt that the kind of inputs that you could bring in to a class when you've done some work, and also the clarity that you have in terms of what you want to get out of an MBA, is very different once you've been in a working environment and you know what it takes or what happens in the real world. Right. I was very naive, and I really didn't know the way I used to pick my subjects was who's the best professor in terms of who's a most engaging professor, who's a good storyteller. That was the only criteria. I shouldn't sleep in the class. So I should find this professor who's most engaging, which was not a bad criteria.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think I didn't take some of the courses which I would have, in looking back, I would have definitely wanted to take, like a brand management. I thought brand is too fluffy. What is brand management?
Right. Yeah.
And that was one of the courses I completely skipped. Consumer behavior, I completely skipped. And if I were to look back, those are probably the most important things I should have taken for what was coming up in future.
Right.
But yeah, that's me.
Amazing, amazing. And then you went into consulting for a while. Right?
So after MBA again, since I hadn't worked, I didn't know what I wanted. I was, you know, fresh off the mill. So everyone told me that consulting keeps your options open. So since I didn't know what I wanted, right, the choice was dictated by, okay, let me keep my options open. And consulting was supposed to have the best exit options. So that's the reason why I landed in consulting. And to be honest, the first few years, I really loved consulting because the travel was new for me. I could travel to so many different places. And I had a very, very strong peer group who were all extremely intelligent, very, very talented. And the kind of conversations, I mean, if I go back to the kind of conversations we used to have in 2007-8 about the Indian economy, and many of those peers who were with me in consulting today are in great positions in the government today. So, those kind of talent was very rare to find, and I'm very fortunate that I was part of that peer group.
Nice.
But in a few years, I outgrew consulting. I realized that, you know, I can't do this forever. That the very same things I liked about consulting, like the travel, the diversity, the variety, started gnawing on me because I never got to see anything through to completion, right? All projects were 3 months, 6 months. So I would come in, I would do the diagnostic, I would do the recommendations, I would create a beautiful strategy, but then I never got to see what's the impact of all that.
Right.
So after a point, I really started getting impatient about wanting to get my hands dirty, take real accountability and ownership of results.
Yeah.
So that's when I decided I had to move to industry. The only problem being that nobody in industry would touch me because I didn't have any experience in the industry. And even within industry, I figured that I wanted to be on the consumer side. I'd done a lot of work on the industrial side in aviation, energy, steel, and many sectors like that.
Right.
But I was more inclined on the consumer side purely because I could see that on the consumer side, the consumer behavior element of it was so interesting and so fast evolving that that's what I was more interested in. So I wanted to be on the consumer side. And within consumer also, I realized that retail is something which is very exciting. So I had that hypothesis and I wanted to go into retail. So the factor was that no retailers would want a consultant at that point, except Flipkart, because Flipkart was a very anti-establishment company.
Yes, tell me about it.
And then Flipkart really wanted to bring in first principles thinkers who would question everything and rethink or completely change the way business is being done in retail. And that's where I found a very great fit. And then I moved to Flipkart.
Right.
And since then, I've never looked back. I think I really fell in love with e-commerce and technology and retail after I joined Flipkart. I must say I was very privileged to be to get a window seat into how a new sunrise industry evolves in a country at a very early stage. So it was a great opportunity to be part of that revolution, to play a small part. And I was there in Flipkart from 2013 till 2018, heading up different categories, starting with books, which was then the biggest category, and then later going on to do home furnishing, appliances. Everything except fashion, I think I touched.
Because I was there.
You were there in fashion. Yeah, so that's where we met as well.
Yes, that's right.
And then I think in 2018, we decided as a family, I mean, the Walmart acquisition was done and there were some leadership changes anyway happening. And also, that was a time when we as a family were thinking, okay, now we could probably work abroad, find some global opportunities. And that's the time when Landmark Group reached out.
Right.
And they were looking for someone to come in and build take their digital capabilities to the next level. And I found a place in Dubai. That's the first time I came to the region. It was the 3 years I spent here at that point were very mixed because the first year was great when, you know, Dubai was real Dubai. And then the next 2 years, COVID came, hit. The whole environment changed and everything was different during those 2 years. Overall, retail was disrupted a lot. But still, in those 3 years, I got an opportunity to do things which I had never done before. Set up teams in China, in Indonesia, in Egypt, in very different countries. Build e-commerce businesses in those markets. Understand how different they were from India, from GCC. And also understand the landscape of the GCC e-commerce market. So it was a great opportunity, but I didn't have enough time to really make a solid impact at that point. And because COVID came, a lot of things changed. And around that time, Amazon reached out, except that they reached out from Europe.
Right.
And Amazon has always been a dream company. It's always been, I've always looked up to Jeff Bezos as someone whose principles I resonate very highly with.
Right.
So I couldn't say no to that opportunity. And that's when, as a family, we moved to Europe.
Right.
worked with Amazon in the Europe Luxembourg headquarters for close to 4 years.
Right.
heading up the fashion marketplace business for Amazon.
Right.
Very interesting stint. I would say, if I have to summarize in one sentence, what I learned there is how does a $200 billion company still keep growing at double-digit growth rates?
Right.
it's a very non-trivial thing. Yeah. And there I got to see what it takes, what goes behind such a huge machine to work so efficiently and to get multiple things right at the same time, while harboring the best talent from around the world. So it was a very, very unique and fortunate experience to have.
Right.
And then early this year, Apparel Group reached out and I got an opportunity to come up and work with Sixth Street. So that's how I'm back in the region.
Amazing. What a journey. I didn't say a single word because I was so hooked onto everything that you were saying. I could actually visualize the whole journey, right? Congratulations. I think it's been
a great journey.
Thank you. And from a leader's perspective, right, I think one of the biggest challenges is cultural shifts when you move from, a global organization like Amazon to a regional, behemoth like Sixth Street. But they all bring their different nuances on the culture side of things. How do you kind of adjust cultures? Because at times it could kind of become, difficult to get into a different culture zone. How do you kind of?
I think all my life I keep saying this, that I've switched back and forth between suits and casuals. So
that's a good
one. I started my career in consulting, which was all suited up, right? Along with a necktie, and I was in formals for almost 7 years in my life when I started my career. And then I switched to Flipkart, which was extremely casual, as you know, like people used to come in shorts and jeans.
Yeah.
So it was a complete culture change for me. I think that was probably the first shocker of a culture change for me and where I had to really adapt a lot.
Right.
But then again, moving from Flipkart to Landmark was back to suits, from casuals back to suits. And from Landmark back to Amazon was again back to complete casuals. and that to Europe. Europe is very different culture from both from Asia in general,
right,
where there's a lot more process orientation, a lot more reliance and discipline for systems, a lot of respect for time.
Right.
At the same time, there is also a lot more, also because of the scale of the organization, it was very consultative in its approach, and therefore things could move slower compared to the pace I was used to in Flipkart.
Right.
Right. So I also had to adapt to that.
Yeah.
Reset my expectations on how fast I can move on some of these things. And then coming back to Sixth Street, again, I came back to suits. So I've always switched back and forth. But by now, I was so comfortable switching back and forth that was not a challenge. But I completely acknowledge what you're saying. There is definitely a big culture change between these organizations. One advantage I had when I came back to Sixth Street was I came back as the CEO. So I did have the opportunity to shape the culture of the firm as well.
Amazing.
And kudos to the leadership team at Apparel Group that they never insisted or they never asked me. They always had the philosophy that if you're bringing in someone talented, then you let them run the show and let them bring what they're capable of bringing. So that way they allowed me to shape the culture. And I was truly, genuinely honored by the kind of culture that I saw in Amazon and the leadership principles that have been shaped by Amazon over a period of time. And I've always believed that you don't need to reinvent the wheel when someone has done a great job.
Right.
So some of those principles, which were relevant to the context and it needs to be adapted, I brought it to Sixth Street as well. And ever since we've created our culture code, a unique culture code,
right,
which is inspired by Amazon, but which has its own cultural and regional nuances.
Right.
And that's what has helped us shape that culture. So is it easy to switch? No. And I think for me, if I see, I go back to this quote all the time that it's not the smartest or the fittest that survive. It's always the one who's most adaptable, who survive and who thrive.
Yeah.
So I think your adaptability quotient is far more important than IQ and EQ in the long term.
Right.
And that's something which I have embraced and I look for in the people I hire as well.
Right.
It's one of the key criteria I look for, people who have actually worked across different functions, different industries, which tells me that they've adapted in different contexts and still done well. Right. And also because they understand that language, right? When you work across different functions, different industries, then you get to learn and speak different people's language, which allows you to connect with them deeper and solve problems in a way which takes people along.
Right.
So to me, culture change is real, and it's only going to get faster and more accelerated in future. So it's really important to stay agile and stay flexible to adapt to the environment you find yourself in. At the same time, be proactive in contributing to that environment as well.
Right. Amazing. At Sixth Street, you are in the driver's seat of, you know, building one of the fastest growing fashion businesses in the region. And you touched upon consumer behavior, right? And how, give us some nuggets on how you're seeing that consumerism change in the context of fashion and online fashion in the region.
Sure. So this is one of my favorite topics. I think consumers are divinely incontent.
Yeah.
And their expectations keep evolving over time, and it's our job as brands and businesses to cater to that.
Right.
So the most recent example of consumer expectation change is e-commerce traditionally used to be, or digital commerce traditionally used to be, a place where consumers would go for their planned purchases. Yeah. They would add a cart, they would build their cart over a period of time. Whenever they get a good deal, they check out. That has completely changed now to a place where consumers want instant gratification and they value convenience, which means that what was okay for them, the consumer who was okay to wait for 3 days or 5 days earlier, wants that product or wants their order delivered here and now. And this is exactly why at Sixth Street, we, building on this insight, we were very clear that one of the things that we need to do to be an experiential retailer is to offer the best delivery experience for consumers. And this is also the reason why we launched 60-minute delivery for fashion at scale in UAE and 90 minutes in 5 other countries, all within a span of 6 months, right? So 9 cities, 5 countries, 60-minute and 90-minute delivery with the largest selection in the region. And the whole effort required so many different components to come together, because what we have really done here is, you know, if you think about it, a lot of people have done, and Noon does an amazing job with Noon Minutes, with 15-minute delivery for groceries. And a lot of people have done the same thing in India, other countries, but mostly always in a head category like grocery or FMCG,
right,
where top 10% of SKUs can account for about 70-80% of sales. It's so tough to do in fashion because fashion is so different for different people.
Yeah.
What is fashionable to you is different for me.
Yeah.
And hence it's a tail category, which means that your selection is not is so big that you cannot accommodate that in a dark store.
Right.
Which is why we used our advantage of having a 1,500 plus store footprint to light up our live stores direct to consumers. It sounds easy, but very, very complicated, because there's a lot of tech behind it in terms of how you geofence the consumers. There's a lot of operations involved in terms of the pickers, the runners, the riders, everyone working in unison to get the order to consumer in such a record time.
Right.
So it was a massive effort, but well worth it, because the consumers who experienced it, once you experience it feels like magic and there's no going back.
Yeah.
So we've seen our NPS double. We've seen our repeat rates go up by 50%. And all of this has dramatically improved the customer experience on our platform.
Right.
And those who experience the magic, they go back and spread the word for us.
Yeah.
Right. So to me, this is the best way to not just satisfy that divinely incontent customer, but also to get them to spread the word on your behalf.
Nice, nice. Two follow-up questions to this. I think one is on the other side, you have a large spectrum of brands too, right? You do everything from luxury to mass. And does it change for any of these brands based on the way you structure the business?
Yes. So we do a very broad range of brands, as you said. We have more than 80 brands that we do within our group, and then an overall total of more than 1,000 brands that we do at Sixth Street overall. And the consumer expectations are different for different brands based on the kind of consumer who has the affinity towards that brand, also the price point of the brand. So what we do is we try to create a horizontal capability layer that any brand can potentially leverage. Now, which brand is more likely to leverage it depends on the nuances of the brand itself and the brand strategy, right? So our job in apparel is to create, and we've always looked at creating those horizontal capabilities, which then the brands can easily plug into and figure out for themselves what makes most sense for them. So, which is the same principle that we follow at Sixth Street as well. And interestingly, this is one capability which most brands have been very keen to latch into because it is so addictive that once you experience it, the customer really gets hooked to it, and most brands found value in it. So it's a good endorsement of the fact that this was something which is critical for not just consumers, but for brands to elevate their experience for consumers.
Right, right. And the second question is, there is a myth on price related to speed of delivery. Is it a myth or is it reality that you can actually sell full price fashion if you were giving 60-minute delivery?
So I think this has been a question on every omnichannel retailer's mind. If you go back to any omnichannel retailer and if you think back at why are the top e-commerce platforms today pure place and not from omnichannel, one of the reasons is that most omnichannel retailers have always been worried about, okay, if I sell online, will my realized margins be lower than what it'll be offline?
Yes.
To me, this is a big myth, right? And the reason why it is true, by the way, that there are cases where the online realized margins are lower than offline, but that is purely because of the way the retailer chooses to put the product, which product on which platform, right? If you on the supply side decide to put full price products in the store while exposing your all season products online, then naturally that is what will sell there and therefore you'll get that margin. But there are examples around the world where the online business of the retailer is actually more profitable than offline. Right. A great case in point is Next,
right,
where the online digital business is more than 50% of the business and it's more profitable than offline. So it is a matter of how you design the business model.
Right.
And there are many things that go into it. While it's not trivial to get it right, there is a business model design that you can create which will allow you to realize same margins in online as you can do offline. The second point I would also say is, people tend to confuse that the margins you realize is a function of the platform. Whereas in reality, the margin you realize, irrespective of the platform, is actually a function of the brand equity.
Right.
A brand who has a very strong desirability and who has a limited distribution and who is driven by desire and not a deal will always be able to sell full price, whether it is online or offline.
Right.
On the other hand, a brand that is over-distributed and has gone to a point where it is so discounted in the market that consumers wait for deals to buy the brand will end up selling on discount whether it is online or offline.
Right.
So it is less a function of the channel or the platform. It's more a function of the brand and its equity.
Amazing. That's a masterclass in brand management right now. And I think from a consumer perspective, right, you've seen consumers in India, Germany, in the Middle East. What's one trend that you find is like common across these three and one that's very different to each and very specific to each country?
Interesting. So I've always believed that consumers are more alike than you imagine. And why I say this is consumers in the same economic segment are more alike than you would imagine, right?
Okay.
What is different is that in each country, in each region, the relative size of the economic segments is very, very different.
Right.
And which then when you generalize as a consumer segment, you tend to ascribe it being very different, right? So the consumers in the top end segment, whether they're in Europe, whether they're in India or in the GCC, they all have similar taste where they value convenience. They are not they're not price sensitive at all. And they have a very high frequency of purchase. They have very high repeat rates, but they expect the best in customer service. So they expect that, they have completely hassle-free return experience. They expect VIP customer service. They expect super fast deliveries. They expect reliability. Their expectations are sky high, but at the same time, they are not price sensitive and they're great customers with high lifetime value. And usually every platform is fighting for this customer because and for their loyalty because these customers are very high value customers. Then there's a second segment of customers, which are, let's say, the mid segment of customers, which tends to be high volume customers, especially in market, both developed markets like Europe and GCC, who do care about experience, but they are also value conscious. And therefore, you need to strike a very good, relevant balance between offering a great experience, but also in a very efficient way. And you know, their budgets are such that their frequency might not be as high as the top segment, but they do have needs, and they tend to evaluate a lot before they choose who to go with, right? While the top-end customer, once they like an experience, and as long as you consistently deliver that experience, they will stick to you. This consumer is actually more likely to switch between players based on the kind of deals they get, and therefore it's more harder to retain them, and you also need to be more in the face. Because they're not as frequent customer, you need to, in a category-like fashion, you need to reach out to them through multiple impulsive purchase channels and so on.
Right.
And then there is the bottom funnel of customers, which happens to be a very large segment in a country like India.
Right. Because
by virtue of the way the country is organized today, and over a period of time, that segment will start growing as well. Where this customer is highly value conscious.
Right.
There you know that this consumer needs the deals, they need the discount. And hence, this is also why you'll see that in Indian platforms, even the best of platforms like a Myntra would always be focusing a lot on deals and discounts, right? It is by design, because that segment of the population happens to be very big.
Right.
So it's a duality, but just to revisit it, I think consumers are more alike than you imagine in a given economic segment.
Right.
But the relative size of the economic segments are very different across different countries. And that brings forth the difference in your business model to be able to cater to these.
Right.
And this also tells you where the opportunity lies for vertical platforms or new platforms to emerge, where the horizontals are either not able to focus or it's not a priority for them to focus.
Great, great point. And I think sticking to consumers again, there's a lot of conversation around Gen Zs and how they are shaping how brands interact with them, right? Any key learnings in the GCC from that perspective?
So I think one thing I would say is that every new generation wants to be different from its previous generation. It has always been the case. It will always be the case. So I think when it comes to Gen Z, there are certain elements on which they like to differentiate themselves from the previous generations. And while I will not go into the details of those, I think the important thing for us is, as retailers, as brands, is to be very clear about who we want to cater to, what our positioning is. Because one of the things I strongly believe in is that the only moat you can build for yourself is brand.
Right.
And that exists inside the consumer's mind, right? Everything else you do, whether it is technology, whether it is operations, logistics, all of that can be copied and will be copied by someone hungrier than you, right? The only thing that eventually, or what others cannot easily copy from you, is how consumers feel about you, which is what your brand is.
Right.
Now, you need to be very clear who you are catering to as a brand and what is the positioning you want to have in the consumer's mind. And therefore, you know, if you are clear that you want to be a young brand that appeals to Gen Z, then you really do want to understand what is some unique elements where Gen Z wants to be different from the previous generations.
Right.
And then, you know, anchor everything you do towards achieving that goal. And when I say everything, right from the product to the delivery, the service experience, to the way your ads talk, the creative language, the communication, everything needs to be in that tone which appeals to that segment to create that particular distinctive positioning in the mind of the consumer.
Right.
Easy to say,
very difficult to do. Yeah.
but this is the key part about appealing to a younger generation or a Gen Z generation.
Right. Nice. I think going back to the Sixth Street question, right? You were one of the first brands to introduce a digital store. Tell us about how that experience has been, and do you see this trend growing?
Sure. So I think I must say that the digital store was created well before my time, but I still feel very proud to be associated with a company that's created something as innovative and future forward as a digital store. And just for listeners to understand what a phygital store is, so we have a store in Dubai Hills, which is which brings the best of both the physical and digital worlds, where this store offers over 1,000 brands in one store, and you can potentially try out all these options while having a online-ish experience of going through a screen to select the products, choose the products, but then being able to try those products out before you choose whether you want to buy or not. So it actually combines the best of both digital world as well as physical world. So it's a very unique concept. And the customers who have come to the store and experience the store, they just love it and they can't stop talking about it, which has been the franchise that we've built. But whenever you come up with a very unique concept, the challenge also is that it's difficult for customers to understand what the concept is, right? Yeah. So selling a concept is the tough part of the journey, which we are constantly doing. And over a period of time, you know, we're seeing that result into business numbers as well. But for us, this store serves multiple purposes. So one is it is a symbol of the innovation that we stand for as a company. Second is that it is a strong brand building effort for us, because unlike other pure play e-commerce players who don't have any physical presence, this actually provides a physical presence which builds a layer of trust, which is intangible but invaluable as well.
Right.
And thirdly, it is one of those places where consumers are also able to understand real and get real-time feedback from our consumers, which otherwise a digital player tends to miss. And that feedback is highly valuable, not just for the store, but also for our online business.
Right.
So to us, this has been an invaluable investment, which we believe will scale. And while we've started this trend, I'm sure it's just a matter of time before others copy. And yes, this concept has existed in other regions like US and Europe already. And there are big players who have gone down this route. So in this region, we are the pioneers. And we plan to expand this further into at least 3 other countries over a period of time.
Right. I think you rightly touched upon innovation. And most of the times between innovation, growth, and profitability, innovation most of the times is the first one to get executed out, right? Because you start focusing on your KPIs for both profitability and growth. But if you were in this situation, how would you kind of prioritize which KPI to go after?
So I think one thing we say very proudly in Apparel Group is that we are not an or company, we are an and company. What we mean by that is we want growth, we want to do it profitably, while we innovate and transform for tomorrow. So for us, all three go together, right? And anybody can do, and this is what we say and we believe in, right? Anybody can do one of the three or two of the three. But doing all three together is the real challenge, and that's why we are here. That's why we need the best talent out here.
Right.
So, and we really live by this, right? Yeah. So whichever element or function we take, we live by this.
Right.
So for us, innovation is core to our growth. So when we talk about growth, we are not just talking about incremental growth. We always set ourselves such an ambitious vision that it will require us to think big or think step change rather than incremental, right? So we always question ourselves, are we thinking incrementally? Are we thinking a step change? For us, when there is a high risk step change option presented along with a incremental low risk assured option, we always go for the high risk option.
Right.
And this is all kudos to the leadership team, who is very bold, very risk taking, and willing to really take those bold big bold bets and commit to them as well.
Right. I think coming to the next segment, which is all about the future, right? And say between now and 2030 or 2035, there are a lot of visions that are available, right? The Saudi government has its vision, the UAE government has its vision, and not specific to Sixth Street or your current role, but what are the key trends you are seeing that are going to change online fashion in the next, say, 5-10 years?
So I think two important things I would like to talk about. So one is that if you see a very well documented, understood thing is consumers are moving away from search and towards more of conversations.
Yes.
Thanks to ChatGPT, Perplexity, and other platforms. There is no reason why shopping wouldn't go that way, right? So we do believe that shopping will also become more conversational over a period of time.
Right.
Now, how that happens is really where the players in the industry today and the startups need to really think through this, right? So this conversations can either happen within the existing shopping platforms, which we believe will happen, which is why we've developed our own shopping assist, fashion shopping assistant, customer service assistant, all of it, which are intelligent chatbots, which is able to guide discovery and help customers find solutions to their problems. The other way this could also happen is that the existing chat platforms, whether it is ChatGPT or Perplexity, they would also have catalogs integrated for shopping within those platforms. So I believe a combination of both will happen. And therefore, in future, we might see a world, let's say in 2030, if I zoom out to 2030 or 2035, we might see a world where consumers will have few super apps, some for functional needs or utilities, some for aspirational needs, and these super apps will have their own integrated conversation assistants. And then there will be conversational apps, which will also have shopping as one of their services.
Right.
So I see a world where both will happen.
Right.
Now, who wins, how it shapes, it's all a function of the execution, the quality of execution, speed of execution. So that I will leave it
right.
For it to play out.
Right.
The second thing which I will also talk about, and I think it's very important to talk about, is what is the future of omnichannel? What is the future of stores?
Right.
So I see a world where digital penetration will continue to increase and continue to accelerate. But the way it will accelerate, I strongly believe, will be through stores.
Right.
And what I mean by that is that stores will increasingly be the fulfillment engines for the digital commerce as well.
Right.
So today, we strongly believe in it. And for us, already there are 800 plus stores that are fulfilling our online orders.
Right.
Right. And this is just the starting. We haven't even explored all our potential and where we want to go.
Right.
What this would also mean is that the way the stores are structured today, right, if it is structured as 80% front store and 20% back store, in 2030, we might see a situation where you may have the same store with 60% front store and 40% back store. Where you have a dedicated fulfillment arm, which is doing more operations from the back store.
Right.
And these back stores will evolve themselves from what they are today to more warehouse grade precision in their inventory accuracy, as well as picking, packing, and so on.
Right.
So this is a big change. It's a big cultural transformation. So we will still need people. It's just that the people's roles and their JDs and KPIs will keep evolving over time.
Right.
And those stores will still remain relevant. And the front stores, which will continue to be there, will be more experiential, ever more experiential than it is today. And the back stores will become more and more efficient towards, focused towards fulfillment.
Great. And from a personal perspective, what is your current hands-on experience with all the ChatGPT, Perplexity, and other platforms? Do you spend a lot of time on those, or yeah. do you use them for productivity and stuff?
Yeah. So I think I've been very conscious about how I use these platforms.
Right.
Because I've experienced the power of these platforms. I'll start with an anecdote. So in Europe, when my washing machine broke down, it was right after 2 years after I purchased that washing machine, and it was out of warranty. So when I went to the retailer asking them to help me with it, they quoted a price which was double of the price at which I purchased the washing machine for. Which didn't make any sense. And I didn't have the heart to throw the washing machine away because I knew it was a small problem and someone can solve it. So thanks to ChatGPT, I learned what it takes to solve that problem. And I think in about 45 minutes, I was able to solve it myself.
Wow, okay.
Right? So I mean, someone who had no understanding of how to do it can learn. So today, in today's world, if you want to learn anything at all, as long as you have the will and the basic talent or skills,
right.
I think you can learn anything.
Right.
But this is also the counterpoint, and the reason why I said I'm very cautious about how I use is because I'm very conscious of the fact that I don't want these platforms to replace my brain and my thinking. So I do use multiple tools. I use Gamma, I use Claude, I use ChatGPT, I also use Perplexity for multiple things. But the way I use them is after I've done my thinking. So I do my thinking, I form my thoughts, I form a point of view, and then I use them either to brainstorm or to create a form factor like a PPT or something in a form that I needed to create for me, or to critique what I have created and then to tell me different points of view which I would otherwise not have thought through.
Right.
I'd never use the tools to create in the first place.
Right.
So to me, that initial creation resting with me is very important so that the originality comes in and right. my authenticity comes in.
Right.
And then these tools act as my advisors or assistants. That's the role I've given to these tools.
You can actually do a podcast on this yourself. you kind of mastered this, right? So yeah, amazing. I think Vivek, we're almost to the end of sure. the segment. Anything that you'd like to tell our listeners from, you know, who now getting into a career of either retail or e-commerce, any...
I think more broadly, what I would say is, I have always, I've thought of my role as an operator by day and teacher by night. And I believe that every leader should do that, which is you build, you learn, and then you share or teach. And then iterate. This cycle is such a virtuous cycle that it's so important for you to give back what you've learned so that others can start with their starting point can be at a point where you are already reached. And that to me perpetuates that virtuous cycle.
Amazing. And where can our listeners follow you?
The only platform where I'm active is LinkedIn. So feel free to, reach out on LinkedIn.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Vivek. That's been a great conversation. I think I've been so engrossed that I've gone back and forth in time. Thank you very much for sharing all these nuggets. I think our listeners are going to benefit immensely from this. Until next time, we will come back to you with a new leader. Don't forget to follow Find, that's FIND.com. It's Find with a Y. If you want to know why Find is spelled with a Y, DM me and I'll let you know. Until next time, stay strong, stay healthy, be happy and cheerful.
Thank you. Thank you, Tharam.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Vivek. Thank you.